Hey, it's Joe. Today on episode 149, I am starting on a two-part series on near-infrared light, that portion of the light spectrum that is between the visible red and the infrared that we feel as heat. Scott Zimmerman is my guest today. He says we are right now experiencing the largest reduction in solar exposure in the history of humanity, and the biggest missing piece is the near-infrared light that we cannot see or feel, but is everywhere outside and nowhere inside. Scott Zimmerman is an optical engineer working with a cross-functional team of experts, including biologist Glenn Jeffrey and astrophysicist Bob Fosbury, to understand the health effects of the wavelengths of light that modern humans have eliminated from their indoor environments in pursuit of energy efficiency. Fortunately for us wise athletes, the solution is easy. Go outside. And we're not talking about sun tanning or getting your vitamin D. We're just talking about getting outside in the sunlight. Not necessarily in the direct sunlight, but sitting in a shade under a tree, wearing a big hat, covered up in clothes, all of it works for getting near-infrared light. But failing that, you have got to get some near-infrared wavelength light back into your indoor spaces. All right, let's talk to Scott Zimmerman and find out how. Scott Zimmerman, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the time.
Yeah. I'm going to talk about you as being kind of an unusual person who has expertise in two things, which are talked a lot about, but rarely together. And one is artificial lighting, and the other is the health benefits of sunlight. And all of the stuff that you talk about, I think, is talked about by other people, but only in isolation. I think that the thing that really kind of started my eyes to being more opened was you talking about how they come together. It's the same conversation. And buying red lights or trying to manufacture the sun to get all of the benefits of the sun, well, it's better than nothing, yes, but gosh, why not just get some freaking sunshine?
Yeah. To me, it's funny when you say that, because one of the first things we do when anybody comes and looks at some of our products, we say, go outside, because yeah. The reality is that's the best approach, and it's free. A lot of people say I'm the worst marketing guy in the world for a product, but the truth is that we can't replicate indoors what's outdoors, you know? Yeah. And to your point of not wanting to get off into the grounding and EMF, you know, it's really hard when you start trying to separate out all the confounding variables. The fact that you're outdoors when you're getting grounding, in my opinion, is the reason that grounding's good. You know,
I could believe that.
You know, and there's just so many of those things where everybody wants to find that one thing that's going to make I'm going to live forever and I'm going to never have a sickness or anything like that. You know, I'm afraid that just doesn't exist because they all kind of compound on top of each other in different ways. And certain people react different ways to things and that thing. What I will say is that when I first started doing this, looking at, you know, sunlight, and we're still trying to actually define what sunlight really is, because as much as everybody thinks they know what it is, there's a lot of subtleties that are built in, and that's what's been so interesting about working with Bob Fosbury and Glenn Jeffrey and Roger Seholt, you know, is that we're all bringing different things to it. I mean, Bob's an astrophysicist. I'm an optical engineer. Glenn's the world's expert on the eye biology of the eye. You know, Roger Seholt's got 4 medical degrees. He's looking at from a practical standpoint, how do I keep my patients well or make them well? So you put all that together and you get this kind of blows silos apart. And, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm having a question about, okay, how do we get UVB? Everybody says, well, it's from direct sunlight. The reality is the majority of UVB is being scattered, just like the blue in the sky. In the UV, it's even more scattered. So it's coming in from all directions. So nature has set up this situation where if the only way we got UVB or for vitamin D production was from direct sunlight, how do people in shadows get it? Well, what happens is it literally, you know, comes into the atmosphere, gets scattered by Rayleigh scattering, and it comes in to our body from all different directions. And Bob's done some measurements and shown that that, hey, you know, you're actually you're actually getting more of the UVB coming in from higher angles than you are from direct sunlight. So people walking outside, and it's not that they're terrible that they're walking out in direct sunlight, but the simple fact that you are exposed to a blue sky, it's coming into you from all directions, and that's where you get the majority of your UVB. So sunlight is kind of like a vague term that everybody thinks they know what it is, but when you get into the physics of it, you know, like the trees are reflecting the near-infrared component that we've shown, so that we're kind of walking around in this integrating sphere of near-infrared associated with reflections off the trees. And so, you know, the majority of the literature sits there and talks only about direct sunlight. But when direct sunlight comes into nature, it gets redistributed, filtered, changed, and so that you get this huge shift. If you look at the actual photons that go into the body, they're actually been modified from what people think about as direct sunlight or the ASTM 1.5, whatever they want to use for the standard. And the fact that we've missed that is really where I think some of the big problems with a lot of the literature is. When I first started doing stuff with melatonin with Russ, you know, he said, Scott, you know, biologists haven't looked at any of the effect of light. They don't understand light. They're not even including it in yet. Just like, you know, you've had a chemistry class or whatever way back when, how do you increase the reaction rate of a process? You add a little bit of energy into it, heat. All of a sudden, the reaction goes faster. And so at the bottom line, if you look at how sunlight works in the body, it mainly makes it so that we're more efficient at generating ATP, which is what Glenn has shown, at convert the ETC chain is actually running a little bit more efficient, where you have a little bit higher level of immune response. Our innate immune system is kicked up. T cells are running a little bit faster. So the real benefit of sunlight is it kind of resets. When we walk outside, we are operating at a different level than when we're not outside. And so that's where, you know, the efficiency of how you train for exercise or the way that you do, take food and convert it into energy is all being enhanced by the fact that we've brought up the level of all these different microstates. So all these molecules are sitting there saying, hey, I'm ready to do something a little bit more than when I was in the dark. It's really kind of a simplistic thing when you think about it. Back to your chemistry thing, if you're trying to actually speed up a reaction, you add heat. Well, there's a difference between heat and sunlight in that the quality of those photons is actually higher efficiency than just trying to add heat in.
Awesome. Okay, let's start then. I'm not faking this. I am an older athlete.
Yeah.
I am just trying to figure out how to be as healthy and as good an athlete as I can and live as long as I can. All of the value that I get out of this is from learning, and I get to talk to the smartest people in the world.
I appreciate that. And then please, I'm just an optical engineer. One of the things I've been blessed with is that there's a lot of people out there who are experts in certain areas that have been willing to talk to me, because the idea of looking at, you know, as strange as it may seem, nobody had really looked at the optics of the human body. We didn't understand how light was propagating in the body. You still are arguing about basic things in that. And there's very little, especially when you get over into talking about people with darker skin color or gender or any of these other things. There's huge differences optically between a man, a woman, a child, someone with dark skin, someone with light skin. That's why I find so interesting and almost humbling about the whole optics of the body is that nobody really looked at it, to be quite honest, and only in a very superficial manner.
One of the things that's, I think, an obstacle to the science emerging has been just sort of how biologists are not physicists, and they don't know enough about physics to see how physics can help. You know, you go down this path, as we do in everything, where all models are wrong. Some models are useful. And there probably should be something tacked onto the end of that that says, and the ones that are useful sometimes stop being useful at some point. You know, let's say you're using a map about the terrain, but you're trying to find rock holds for climbing up a cliff. Well, now you're at a level of granularity that topographical map just can't help you. So now that map that was useful is not useful anymore. And so now that we've got better instruments and we've got people who, you know, like Bob, who know physics getting into this space, they are bringing things to bear, information to bear that just wasn't there before or wasn't understandable by the people who never studied any of that stuff. And so this whole quantum thing, you know, has been stolen by all of the fakers on the internet trying to sell something. That doesn't mean that there isn't some truth to it, but a lot of it gets into the woo-woo and it's, you know, just, you know, buy my mat or whatever. I'm going to ask you to tell us about yourself, but for the audience's sake and for my sake, I wanted to start by just saying that I am late to the sunlight is health party. I grew up in South Florida, so I grew up in the sun. I never questioned the sun. The sun feels great. I love the sun. I see the sun. I feel happy. So I never thought sun was bad for me, but still, sun being a health thing, I don't know about that. And that's just because I'm sort of a conservative person. I don't let myself believe things that I can't really understand. Yeah, I bought into the whole vitamin D is good and I should have enough vitamin D. And I made a point to get some sunshine to get my vitamin D, but shining a red light on my skin is somehow going to be good for me? No, I wasn't going to say no, it couldn't be true, but it's just like, I'm not going to believe that. I just don't think so. But I ended up being desperate at one point. I was having knee pain and I tried everything and nothing solved the knee pain. And so I was willing to try anything. Somebody said, well, for $300, you can try a red near infrared lamp and that's good for joint pain. And I went, $300? I'm doing it. And by God, it worked. I was tickled to death that I was wrong about that. But now I wanted to know why did it work? And no one could explain it to me. And I have to say that even though I've been using it every day for a year and a half now, because that shit just works, I'm not going to stop just because I don't understand it. I just wanted to know, why did that help? You know, I even had a podcast on the topic and I really walked away still not understanding. And it wasn't until I bumped into you on the internet and you talking about it, and you're kind of an odd combination of skills. You are a longtime light engineer. You build things to make artificial lights and I like having light inside my house, so that's useful. Didn't understand how that might affect my health at all. But you also have become an expert, I think, in sunlight, the original source of light. And in listening to you talk, you are sort of bringing these two topics together to help people like me and my audience to understand how we can be healthier. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, but in any case, tell us about your background and how did you get to here?
Well, I started out doing a mechanical engineer, doing avionics, and then they came across and said, well, we need somebody looking at displays, and we've had these problems with these displays under sunlight conditions. We were building avionics for Desert Storm. They needed to actually mimic the characteristics of sunlight in the desert. So I built a system where I used multiple different light sources, put it together to mimic sunlight. And lo and behold, once we added all the components of sunlight, we could replicate the failures that they were having, the chemistry changes that were going on inside these liquid crystal displays. I kept on working in that area, and I came up with some ideas about that are in some of your cell phones and things like that. I got sent back to the research center, and I was lucky enough to work with 350 PhDs and understand a little bit how they talk a different language than I talk, and sure talk a different language than the guys that are trying to start businesses talk. So it was kind of a great education experience for me. So I started a couple of companies, and now our latest company is we're basically trying to mimic sunlight in a light bulb. What people don't particularly understand is that we're going through, can easily be classified from an energy standpoint as the largest reduction in solar exposure in human history. Kids are indoors under artificial lighting. They're in front of TVs that don't put out anything close to what you think is sunlight. And, you know, even their sports are under artificial lighting anymore. We spend all our time indoors. We put in windows that block all the near infrared. To your point about sunlight, you know, everybody says, I understand sunlight. They don't. I mean, we don't even. But what we're trying to do is trying to show that different portions of the solar spectrum mechanistically are changing things in your body. And that's an important thing. And most importantly, it's very important that you get the ratios right. If you don't have the right ratios, then you start to create imbalances in the body that things like ATP production rates slow down. But if you kick it up like you did with your red light on your knee, then that area at least is getting some enhanced performance at generating ATP and other things. We don't know what all those things are. Biologists have never even looked. I mean, the real problem with the biology, not problem, but the issue is that they take a Petri dish, they put some cells in it, they put it in a look under the microscope, and they say, something's going on. Then they put some more chemicals in or some drugs in or whatever, but they're never taking into account that the actual processes that they're looking at are changing as a function of solar illumination. Because when you go outside, you are changing the operational point of those molecules to where they're either more efficient, not as efficient, doing all kinds of things. And that's what I've been focused on. My goal is essentially to understand from a mechanistic standpoint what sunlight is doing in the body. And that you'd think we'd know that, but we don't. And that's what's been so great about working with Glenn and working with Bob is they're bringing in, you know, Bob's looking at it from an astrophysicist standpoint of how light actually propagates and where it goes and reflection and measuring and, you know, transmission in the body and things of that nature. And Glenn's looking at biologically, you know, saying, I can't do anything in a Petri dish. I got to go get some people. And he starts taking people and, you know, shining light on them. And all of a sudden things are changing that he can measure. If I can take anything away from this whole conversation that we have is that the number of processes that are going on in the body simultaneously. When you read a paper or something like that on red light therapy or whatever, they're focused in on one biomarker. Imagine that the body is doing thousands of those all the time at the same time and trying to get to some point where we're happy, you know, we survive. You know, that's the thing that's so cool about what's going on. Because every time you turn around, melatonin is enhanced here, melatonin is dropped here, cortisol is increased over there. These aren't just happening individually. They're happening simultaneously. And if you get those things out of whack, which is what I believe is what's happened by getting the ratios of sunlight, the different parts of the spectrum, because each part of the spectrum is doing something different to some process in the body, then you start creating a harmful situation. And that's what I believe. I started this out, I was just trying to make a light that was a little bit better. And then I got into looking at some of the deeper into what's going on. And then I had my granddaughter get into neuroblastoma and the cancer associated with that. And I was saying, hey, you know, there is stuff going on here where they're enhancing the effect of different chemos and stuff like that. Can't we talk about it? Nobody wanted to talk about it. So I kind of, my wife and I have kind of made this our mission to kind of go in and try and understand some of these mechanisms. Because, you know, if we can do anything to even enhance a little bit the effects of some of the chemos and things like that, that's my end goal. But in the process, I have to actually make money and do something. And fortunately, I've been able to team up, like I said, with other people that are real experts in the field and combine it with what I do in the optics side. And so that's kind of the end goal. And I have 85 issued patents, and so I do know how to invent a few things. It's been, to me, about the most humbling thing I've ever done because there's so little that we really understand about what's going on with the body and sunlight, even though it's been with us forever.
Yeah. I guess I'd characterize you as a synthesizer. You bring together the expertise of specialists, and then you figure out how to engineer it into something useful.
Well, I think to become the world's expert at one particular thing means that you have to essentially ignore a lot of other things, in my opinion.
Sure.
There's very few people that are still generalists. And I consider myself a generalist from the standpoint of an engineer at heart, but I can talk the language of the people that are a whole lot smarter than I am. And they can explain it to me in terms that we're kind of having this conversation now, that gets us one step closer to understanding the real mechanisms going on. And I think what's so exciting right now is that there's all these new biosensors coming on. You're going to be able to continuous glucose monitoring and all these other things that are coming online. People can then now judge the effect. You did the red light therapy on your knee and you found an effect. Yeah. That could maybe be great. It makes great for you. Next person might have a different thing. And the more we see get that data, the more you can start to understand what is the true effect. You know, what are the mechanisms that are going on that we really need to care about? Because to your point, that red light panel is not putting out very many joules of energy. You're not leaving it on all day, but it's making a difference. And it's making a difference because there are at least two or maybe more hormones or enzymes that are being affected to where it shifts the process and takes away some of your pain and makes it more efficient at how it generates ATP or whatever. You know, that's what I think is so exciting about what's going on now is we're starting to get things where we can actually measure. Typical circadian is looking at things happening on a time scale of a day. But what we're looking at is things that literally in 5 to 10 minutes, you've changed the actual processes in the body. And so that needs to be added in to anything you look at for circadian. I did the paper with Russ where we looked at the transient response of melatonin. So when you go out and you exercise, cortisol goes up instantly. And melatonin both go up in your blood in about 10 minutes. It goes up, it stabilizes based on the amount of exercise you're doing. And then as you stop exercising, those things come back down to baseline. The difference between you having exercise during the day and not exercising is changing the amount of melatonin that's in the body. And this is melatonin not from the pineal gland because the exercise was being done at 9 o'clock in the morning. And it's a huge amount, like 200 picograms per milliliter, larger than what you'd normally see at night in the blood. Right. So what's going on is that there are transient short-term effects, and then there are longer-term effects, and you have to take those time scales into account. And it has a huge effect because you essentially are building up this reservoir. And what it shows, I think, beyond a shadow of a doubt, is what Russ has been arguing for 40 years, is that all mitochondria are generating melatonin for local use and then for systemic use. So at night, the pineal gland happened to pick melatonin for a good reason. It's the world's best antioxidant. And it's doing that because the brain still needs to function while we sleep and is generating 80% of the energy usage that it normally does. So the pineal gland is pumping melatonin in to essentially deal with all the reactive oxygen species being generated in the brain. And a little bit of that leaks out into the blood, goes into cells that are hurting a little bit. But each one of those cells, trillions and trillions of mitochondria, are generating melatonin all day long. It's just being consumed in the cells rather than being pumped around by out from the pineal gland.
Yeah, that's very interesting to me. And I know people who take large doses of melatonin and they take it during the day, and it does not make them sleepy. So it's believable that the melatonin has different effects at different times. I wonder if melatonin has always been an antioxidant and more recently became a sleepy effect on our brain. Then I wonder if the reason that we make it in the pineal gland in the dark is because our cells are not getting any light from the sun at night. And so that's the signal to make our own melatonin to distribute to the body for the purpose you were just mentioning, for the antioxidant effect. It also makes you sleepy.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I think is when we did pull together the data from Theron along with the data from Gao, it showed the two relationship of cortisol and melatonin and how they work together during stressors like exercise and, going out in the sun. After you do a good exercise, after you go out in the sun, you get this kind of sleepy effect. I feel a little bit sleepy. Well, our argument is that if you believe the Theron data, what happens is that when you're doing something outside, whatever, you get this pump up in melatonin because the muscles and all that are generating excess melatonin to deal with the reactive oxygen species they're doing. And this is, like I say, 9 o'clock in the morning. Not supposed to be doing this, but it happens. What ends up happening is you get this boost in melatonin, but then it takes melatonin quite a while to actually get back to bound baseline, take a half hour. So you have that kind of excess melatonin in the system, in your blood, wandering around after you do those events. And then you, as I say, I correlate it to the fact that people say, well, I spent the day at the beach and I just feel so tired after I'm done, sleepy after I've been outside a long time, or I did a great run and I feel kind of a little bit relaxed and sleepy. And I would argue based on the data that that is because melatonin has come up. And what was really cool is when you combine it with Gao's data on cortisol, which is very important. We need cortisol. It's our fight or flight response type thing, and adrenaline and all those others. What Gao showed was is that as you went into exercise and you continued the exercise, all of a sudden the cortisol after about 10 minutes started to fall off. Well, there's some papers out there that show that melatonin suppresses ACTH, which then suppresses cortisol. And when I say a lot of times you need to have the right ratios and you need to look at more than one biomarker, it's the combination. Cortisol is pumping you up. Melatonin is calming you down. The body's doing it during the middle of the day. Where in the heck is all this melatonin coming from? We're arguing it comes from all the mitochondria, and all the mitochondria are using it. And only in cases where you have really high levels of stress or stressors do you actually see it in the blood, because it's being used locally and consumed locally, because melatonin is the body's premier antioxidant. That's the argument.
Yeah, I guess the thing that strikes me is how similar this light story is to highly processed food story. George Burns famously said one time, the key to success is sincerity. And when you can fake sincerity, you've got it made. And so our food industrial complex has, in an effort to make money and feed people, has tried to figure out a way to disassemble things and combine chemicals together to give us the macros we need and, the squirts of the right vitamins that are necessary so that they can market and sell this stuff that they have engineered to be, quote unquote, highly palatable. And they can claim that it's also healthy because it's got these things added to it. And it turns out that they just are not good for us anyway, despite all of the efforts to try to make it as healthy as possible. And when you try to figure out, well, what should you eat? It's like, well, just eat food, eat regular food, things that were alive once, eat a plant or an animal or a fish. And it seems like the lighting story is very similar to that, where because we don't understand, right? There's a whole bunch of wavelengths of light that you can't see. Well, those can't be doing you any good. So, let's stop spending electricity making that stuff that's just heating up my house. And now I got to burn the AC to cool it back off. I'm just going to make, what's the most efficient thing I can do to create visibility so I can, see what I'm doing when I'm in my house. It would be that real blue light that's sort of like in the doctor's office. It's very professional, and you can use very little energy to make it, but it doesn't contain hardly any of the wavelengths of light that you would get in the sun, in particular. But even, when I was a kid, it was incandescent bulbs that were hot. What is the difference between sun and, incandescent bulb light that we had until, 15 years ago, and these LED lights, which everybody's got in their house now and so proud of themselves for how energy efficient they are?
Yeah, and it's really hard because, there is a benefit from the standpoint you can save some energy. I started this out, I was just trusting nature and said, well, I'm going to make a light source that's as close to match to the spectral content of a sunlight. that I can get away with and still meet basic government requirements. The more I dug into it, the more I came to the conclusion that, hey, this is actually harmful, what we're doing. And that's what's been kind of the focus of trying to get the science right on the whole thing. Because what people need to understand is that your eye only responds to about 10% of the solar, less than 10% of the solar spectrum. We don't see the majority, 90% of what the sunlight provides. And it, as you said, it's exactly that statement went on that everybody said, well, if I can't use it for seeing, what good is it? I should just get rid of it. And that's what they've done. The incandescent has an overkill. It actually generates more near infrared and infrared than visible than the sunlight does, even when you look at what all the other effects.
In terms of ratios, you mean?
Ratios. So I talk about the near infrared to visible ratios in optical watts. And if you're out in direct sunlight, they're about equal. Near infrared to visible is about the same number of optical watts as far as a ratio. Bear in mind that what's really important about that statement is that the body assumes in all its processes that it is exposed to something that as a minimum has a more near infrared than visible. And then when you get into walking around and sitting in the shade, you know, the ratio goes up where it's more like 3 or 4 to 1 near infrared to visible. But if you go into a house with LEDs, it goes to 0 because they provide no near infrared, but they have still provide you with the visible. And that's where you start getting these imbalances created. The same thing happens looking at your computer or on your display or your TV at night. And the same thing is happening because the government has mandated the use of low-E glass. So all the near-infrared is being reflected back out of the building, and you're not getting any benefit from sunlight through windows. You know, and then you start looking at that, and plants were here first. They came in, they said, we need energy. We need to make ourselves. And so they use the reds and the blues, reflect the green, reflect the near-infrared, but they take that and they use that. And in an amazing optical effect, literally, I don't want to bore you with the whole thing, but it is probably one of the most ingenious optical nano structure I've ever seen in optics. Literally, there are little, what they call periodic structures that are localizing the reds and the blues, just those wavelengths needed for chlorophyll A and chlorophyll B into the leaf area where it needs to be. And that makes it maximum efficiency. And so why would it be maximum efficiency? Because photosynthesis can only occur within a very limited temperature range. So the plants have set up a system where they are just extracting those two small areas that they need in order to survive. And they're rejecting everything else to keep the temperature of the leaf within a range that makes for photosynthesis secure. The most amazing optical thing I've ever seen in my life.
And so by reject, you mean they reflect it?
Yeah. If you go out and you look at near-infrared photography, you know, and take a picture of a tree, it looks like the entire tree is covered in snow. The grass is all white. Even dirt has a higher reflectivity of near-infrared to visible. So it's kind of like a set of sunglasses, or we're walking around in this environment that the plants, like I say, they got here first, they took what they wanted, and they're rejecting everything else. Now the body, what's left? All the near-infrared, all the infrared is being dumped into the body. And it appears, based on all the mechanisms, and you can look at, there literally we've identified dozens of different mechanisms that are going on in the body, that the simple exposure to the near-infrared seems to enhance that process. Like your knee, red light therapy, near-infrared therapy, it's real, it's doing something. We just don't understand all the pieces as well, but we can see the effect. And they've done studies that testosterone levels in young males goes up when they're outdoors. You get all these different effects, you know,
right.
How far you can go and how much you can claim from a marketing standpoint is kind of where I get upset with some of the red light therapy people. But the reality is that in general, the longer wavelengths penetrate deeper into the body, they affect more of the cells. They're there to essentially enhance our ability to survive. Because bear in mind that the UV and the blues and the violets within the solar spectrum have enough energy to randomly break a molecular bond anywhere they want. That makes it so that the body had to develop what? A sacrificial layer on the outside, which is our skin. Every 21 days or so, it sloughs off, and we use that thin area to generate vitamin D. And it's just amazing when you start looking at Bob and I are just looking at this thing and say, wow, is that ever elegant? Is that ever amazing? How in the heck did they figure out how to do all that? Because, you know, we're seeing all these microstructures, nanostructures, we're seeing all these things that the body is going to extreme lengths to localize near infrared at higher in your eye is a great example. Majority of the photons that hit the retina don't go through your pupil. They actually go through your eyelid and the sclera, and it's near infrared because the eye is this amazing imaging of optic for us to see in the visible, but in the near infrared, it literally is translating. And you can actually see this effect. It's called the red edge. You literally go outside, close your eyes, look towards the sun, and you'll see this nice orange glow inside, you know, with your eyelids shut. And that is this edge, and it goes all the way out to 1200, 1300 nanometers. That's a transmission window. But literally, because of the geometry of the eye, you get a 10x to near infrared to visible at the retina when you're outdoors in sunlight. Again, when you're indoors, it's zero because there's no near infrared.
Right. Well, and I guess there's going to be a measure of faith here because, as you said, we don't really fully understand how it is all working. Something I read this year that was really sort of astonishing to me as a layperson was that, you know, we don't really know how cells work. You know, we can't build a model of how a cell works because we don't know how a cell works. So, you know, we're just sort of doing associations. You know, we put a lot of this in and this other stuff happens afterward. And so, you know, then we'll sort of speculate about a mechanism of what's going on, but we're not really sure about that. We're better at figuring out how cells work together to create organ functions than we are at understanding how the cell itself actually works. Anyway, getting back to the point, I've read many studies in my pursuit of what the heck is going on with these red lights. I mean, there's all kinds of things. People have been using red light therapy or low-level laser therapy for a while, proof skin, wound healing, I mean, all kinds of things. So, but those are all, you know, how can you do a scientific study on sunlight? You know, it's very hard. So what do? They pick a wavelength and then they just see, you know, does that seem to have an effect? Oh, this wavelength is good. Oh, I'm going to put that in my lamp. I'm going to sell that. Oh, this other wavelength is also good. Okay, I'm going to have two wavelengths in my lamp. All right. It starts to become absurd, really, to think that, oh, it's just those two wavelengths. It's the sunlight that is what matters. And so, you know, getting back to, should we eat reassembled chemicals into highly processed foods that taste really good and include all the things that we know are healthy? Or should we just eat real food? Because it turns out that that's better for you. So probably what the best thing to do is to get the whole spectrum. Even though there have been no studies on every single wavelength, that's how life evolved on the planet that resulted in plants being able to turn sunlight into food for themselves and animals able to turn sunlight into energy for themselves, or perhaps it's just make their process for making energy more efficient. Anyway, maybe you can explain that. But does that sound right to you that
Absolutely.
It's the full spectrum that we need. It's not this wavelength or that wavelength in my lamp.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that people need to understand is that what we do, because incandescents are filament lamps, like the little ones you used to have with the flashlight.
Yeah.
That is essentially 100% efficient at generating near infrared and infrared. 90-95% of the energy photons being generated by those little lamps is in the near infrared to visible. What it's lousy at doing is generating blues and greens and UV. You have to run it up to really high temperature, which makes the bulb, the filament fail early. So in our technology, all we do is we take LEDs that are really good at generating visible light, and we put it in the same bulb, we put in little filaments that are really good at generating near infrared, and it provides the closest match to sunlight that's on the market. Mm. That's what we do. And it gives us 5 to 10 times, depending on what ratio you use. Based on my work with the Black community and John Lewis and children, my belief is that we need to be closer to shade conditions. So we generate a 3-to-1 ratio between the infrared versus the visible in our light bulbs. And the intent is to essentially match up with what sunlight does by the time we actually absorb it. So it's simple to do. The problem is the lighting industry has, and the DOE in particular, has put in place, they've gone the LED route, and they don't want to tell to their customer that, oh, we left out something. And so it's really been difficult to get around. The DOE has put in place certain rule changes that make it hard. They banned the use of incandescents in the country using some rule changes. Now they're trying to ban the use of even our products by increasing the amount of visible only light efficiency. They want 120 lumen per watt now, which is absolutely the stupidest thing I think I've ever seen the government do. Hmm. You know, when you were growing up, your dad may have been under a fluorescent lamp, or you may have been under a fluorescent lamp, but you came home at night to an incandescent that had this huge amount of near infrared that you enjoyed, that helped you sleep. Now that's all going away. And it's so stupid because it's not necessary. I can still give you 50 to 100 lumen per watt efficiencies and add the near infrared back in, but they don't want to do it because they've convinced everybody that LEDs, and even, and it's my personal belief, we're trying to prove that, if you would simply get the amount of near infrared that you were supposed to get during the day, you wouldn't be having the circadian disruption or sleep disruption. Because bear in mind, all the circadian light sources out there are trying to use 400 to 700 nanometers and adjusting the spectrum, the color of that thing, to mimic sunlight. And it doesn't. If you don't have the near-infrared component, you're essentially wasting your time with all these different color-shifting stuff that the industry is doing.
Yeah,
that's kind of the problem we're trying to address, is that we can easily do it. The technology's there. It's not hard to do. And we could even add a little bit of UV in and still have some reasonably efficient light sources. I ran into this one gentleman at one of the big glass companies, window glass companies. And he was an old top engineer there. And I was explaining to him that, hey, we were blocking the near infrared from coming in, and that was causing, changing the biology. And he said, well, that explains it. I said, what? And he said, we kept on shifting the transmission out farther and farther into near infrared in hospitals, and we were getting better patient care results. And he said, we never knew why, but it was doing it. But then we hit the limit that the government said we couldn't provide, we had to block the rest, and so we couldn't go any further. So, I mean, we've almost created this artificial environment. It is probably the worst environment that anybody could possibly come up with, all driven by this need to save energy. And unfortunately, the reality is, even worse, is that by switching over to these higher and higher efficiency LEDs, people are just putting more lights more places, and we're not saving any real energy.
Yeah.
One of the things that is really interesting here lately is that NASA published work on their International Space Station, and they looked at the biology of what people who've been up there for 6 months to a year. Bear in mind, it's all LED. It's also microgravity. It's also a lot of other stuff. What they found is that these people were accelerating aging because their mitochondria were degrading in that environment. We're seeing similar effects in submariners. As Bob likes to say, it's kind of like we have the modern day scurvy, going on, and all these people working at night, if they were simply getting more near infrared and infrared, the industry is basically, especially the red light therapy, they're using sources that are readily available. Not that they're the optimum sources. That's what's available. They can get these LEDs in these particular wavelengths. And they can put 2 or 3 of them in, all that. with an incandescent like we use, you go from 700 out to over 3,000 nanometers, and there's all spectral content throughout there, just like you get when you're out in sunlight. It's easy to do. We can fix it if we want to. The government never should have gotten involved in the thing in the first place. They've been much better off if they just tried to figure out how to convince people to turn their light off occasionally. It is a little frustrating, to be quite honest, because, you know, it's not like this is hard to fix.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that people are really hot and bothered about right now is, you know, the blue light and the, you know, the evils of the blue light. And, the, you know, you've got filters on your glasses that, you know, you pay extra for, or you wear orange glasses at night to try to block the blue lights and things like that. What do you think about the blocking of the blue?
I feel sorry for blue. I mean, it's being picked on. I mean, yes, I totally agree. If you're going to be sitting indoors and you're going to be stuck in front of a computer for 8 hours, even into the night, or watching your TV, then the source that you're looking at needs to probably be attenuated in the blue. But you walk outdoors, you're getting orders of magnitude more blue in a blue sky, because that blue contains mostly near infrared. You don't see it, but it is mostly near infrared. And Bob did this really great thing where he's an expert at spectroscopy. What happens is that in the UV, the blue sky that you're seeing is actually mostly in the shorter wavelengths is UV. It's UVA and UVB. It's coming at you from all different directions at levels that would be considered dangerous by, if you were just looking at it individually inside under, you know, normal conditions or under those kind of conditions. But we're being exposed to that. But then, and you go into the visible, and most of the Raleigh scattering is a wavelength to the fourth. So as you get down into the longer wavelengths, what happens is that you're starting to get this extra bump. It's the reflection of the green grass and the leaves up into the atmosphere and coming back down. So you get another secondary enhancement of near infrared. Always, like I say, nature is always trying to, you're never exposed to visible light and UV light without an excess of near infrared. That is exactly the opposite of what occurs indoors.
Is that protective?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that you look at, I mean, that's one thing you can do with all the literature associated with photobiomodulation and all these other things. They're all showing that the longer wavelengths have a positive influence on certain processes. And we know the other way, UV and blue are capable of creating negative consequences. But if you get them in the right balance, then everything, you know, we survive 100 years looking at a beautiful blue sky. It's orders of magnitude more blue coming out of a sky than what you're getting out of a lot of your things that are supposedly, you know. One of the things that they say is you should, your cell phone should have less than 10 lux. I mean, that's like nothing, or it's going to disrupt you. Well, it could be disrupting you, because the only thing you're turning on when you're looking at that little, that blue light is, you know, the mechanisms to wake you up, cortisol, none of these others. Professor Ray did a study where he looked at, you know, just 800 lux of white light. And he showed that within 30 minutes, the cortisol levels had gone up like 30%. So these things are turning switches, and they're supposed to be done together. And we're only doing one. And that's what's causing these imbalances that get in the way of what we're doing. So, you know, there are thousands of papers out there showing everything from T-cell velocity to sperm motility to vision characteristics. Glenn's doing some amazing stuff now, showing that incandescent is actually more beneficial than the red light therapy, you know, the highest for certain visual things going on. Nothing is going to kill you. No, that's not the point here. The point here is that we're meant to, the body assumes, all its processes are assuming that it's in a certain level of proportionality. And what we've done is done the worst thing you could possibly think of. We have eliminated the, as you say, protective characteristics of sunlight, the portions that do the good stuff. And it's so complicated. there's a this I think we're the first to even think about it. It turns out that at longer wavelengths beyond near infrared into the shortwave infrared, out from, you know, 1.5 microns out to 5 microns, is actually the place where there's the highest density of photons, not energy, but photons, because the water in our body strongly absorbs those wavelengths. Okay? And so you get this high density of photons. Well, it appears, based on the work from Hudson and all, that that is being used by the body to generate hydrogen peroxide in those outer layers of the skin as a barrier for all these, totally surrounded by all kinds of pathogens, bacteria, things like that. The body is appears to be generating a reactive oxygen species layer, barrier. It also appears to be using that hydrogen peroxide to enhance the ability of us to make vitamin D. There's a global shortage of vitamin D in everybody, quote unquote. Well, the whole effect is that those longer wavelengths in the hydrogen peroxide actually enhance the ability of the body to crack cholesterol, 7-DHC, to make everything from cortisol to sex hormones to vitamin D, and it does it all in the skin. And so the body is done, we keep on doing these experiments, we take one wavelength, oh, this is a good thing, but the body is, seems to be saying, okay, I'm going to take these chunk of wavelengths, I'm going to use this to enhance this process at the entirely other end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
And so when we start screwing around with those things, that's when we start creating these issues for people. And it's exactly like you say with processed food. Down deep into that thing of things that they got rid of were some important stuff, you know.
Right. Maybe we still don't even understand what it is, but it's having an effect when we get rid of it.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, you know, we're so focused on one issue, lumens per watt, or, you know, efficiency of the air conditioning system or whatever. And I'm heartened because while the DOE doesn't have a clue what they're talking about and doing anything like that, the architects and people of that nature are starting to wake up and saying, hey, this is hurting my customer, or maybe hurting my customer. That puts me at a big risk. Unfortunately, like I say, a government gets involved where they get oversimplified and don't understand the science, and people then start marketing like crazy that they're gonna, you're gonna save the planet because you put in a light, bright blue light, but you're gonna be at the hospital 10 times longer or quicker than because of it. It's my opinion.
Well, and so people who are worried about cancer, right? I mean, we've been getting warnings about skin cancer, getting too much sun, and it also causes wrinkles, which I'm somewhat familiar with. What I've heard you say is that for the near-infrared light, you don't need to be in direct sunlight. It'll go right through your clothes. It'll go right through your hat. You know, sit on your front porch in the shade under a tree. You'll get what you need in the shade.
Absolutely. In fact, you'll get a better ratio. You know, bear in mind that our body is designed to take almost nine orders of magnitude change in intensity from direct sunlight all the way down to a dark night. And even then, that dark night is not zero. It's a real number of photons still going on. Mm-hmm. But when you start doing things like building a treehouse, great thing for a kid to do if he doesn't fall out and break his leg like I did. But, you know, they're in the environment where the maximum ratio of near infrared to visible is. You know, when you're going and working out at a gym, unfortunately, you may have a great window view, but it's blocking all the near infrared from coming in, blocking some of the any of the UV from coming in. Yeah. And like I say, I think that it's very clear from the data we have so far that in combination, the body is well adapted to be able to handle exposure to sunlight. You know, but we also have enough common sense to go and sit down in the shade in the middle of the afternoon. My grandpa was a dairy farmer. He wore a cotton shirt, long sleeves, overalls, had a straw hat, and when it came time for lunch, go sit underneath a tree. Cotton shirt was blocking the visible portion and the UV portion, but it was letting a ton of near infrared through. It's essentially transparent. And that's what I think is so cool about the more you look at the different parts of the spectrum. And that's the end goal, in my opinion, in this whole thing, is to try and get the idea of light and what light generates into back into our indoor spaces so that we can actually have a higher, lower probability of transmitting diseases and receiving diseases.
To summarize some of that, I think people will have gotten it by now, but just to be sure, that the red end of the spectrum stimulates the mitochondria to function more efficiently, to make more energy and make less reactive oxygen species when it makes energy. It also stimulates the mitochondria to make melatonin to offset the reactive oxygen species that it is making. And I suppose if it's not getting the melatonin, then it's using a glutathione or some other antioxidant that it's got a limited supply of.
Yeah, and I think that's where, you know, there are only four papers that I know of that actually measure hormone levels in real time during a stressor. Everybody else is, you know, when they do circadian, they put somebody down on a bed, they get them nice and calm, they don't let them do anything, no exercise, no nothing. And then they go in and they start measuring melatonin through the night and they can see the response. I'm not disagreeing that there is a response, that it's kind of like a wish list for the body. But if the minute you do anything, all of a sudden melatonin is coming all over the place, you know, in the very high levels, in your sweat, in your saliva, in your plasma, you know, all these things are shown. And so where's it coming from? Well, the one thing that the one set of data that we have, really, or a couple set of data, during exercise, where the muscle cells are very intimate with the blood, you know, system, there is this huge peak, almost, like I say, within 10, 20 minutes, you get this huge peak in melatonin in the blood and cortisol at the same time, at 9 o'clock in the morning. Where did it come from? It didn't come from the pineal gland. Maybe it could have come out of the gut, but if you look at it, it actually stabilizes after you get into your exercise. Mm. And then the minute you stop, all of a sudden it comes crashing back down. And we're talking huge numbers that are, you know, that are bigger or same as what you're getting in a circadian. Mm. So I almost look at circadian as being a symptom of bad solar hygiene. We're not getting the stuff we should have if we had gotten that. So it appears that the body always ends, you know, a stressor with an excess of melatonin. And that's where you get this sleepy feeling at the end of these things.
And everybody knows about, you know, you want to control your blood sugar after a meal, then you go for a walk. Well, you know, I always thought that that was just moving your muscles and it's pulling some sugars out of the bloodstream. But I wonder if it isn't also, you're outside and you're getting near infrared light.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what Glenn's, I mean, you look at what Glenn did with the latest thing he published. He was taking 670 red light and putting it on a portion of the back, about that big. And he gave a bunch of sugar to him. And then he turned the light on for like 5 to 10 minutes, almost no energy whatsoever in a small area of the back. All of a sudden, systemically, he's seeing this drop in the glucose level in the blood that carried on. And then on top of everything else, he measured the CO2, which is a gauge of the efficiency of the ATP, and saw it go way up. So, you know, it doesn't take much to cause in of the right thing at the, you know, he's hitting it with something that is causing a positive effect to on a systemic level. And then what is really amazing is that effect appeared to go on for several days. So it's kind of like we're kicking over a catalyst or an enzyme or something like that, that once you get it going, it kind of has this, I think it's similar to what goes on with melatonin. The body wants to get, you know, you can't have cortisol get out of control. You know, if it goes nuts, you've got a real problem. But the melatonin appears to always be a little bit excess. And then to kind of squash things back down. If you think of it just from a simple control standpoint, if you have some event out here on your arm, you get a puncture or you get a whatever, the idea that there could be a, oh, I did something, the systemic response, that's not what happens. There's a local response that occurs first. And then eventually you get to a systemic response, because the reality is what I need for this one little spot, I don't need over here. So the control systems, there's these layers of control systems where they have feedback loops and they're running in the body. To get those out of whack, you know, is what can cause some of the real problems, is what I believe.
All right, Scott, I think we've painted the picture here. There's tons more for people to learn about if they want to. Where would you send them?
Well, we're trying to put together some more papers to publish on what we're doing, but you know, it's hard because so much of the, I don't believe that the red light therapy, I'm personally, if to fix a problem, I have no problem with it. My big concern is that everybody's going to jump on the bandwagon of getting these big monster panels with 850 nanometers. And I'm very cautious about with some of those, because unlike, you know, it's kind of like a headlight. You look at a headlight, you glance away. You look at sun, you glance away. But in these near-infrared panels, a lot of them are set up to where you're looking at the emitters themselves, and you don't have a glance-away response. So I'm really concerned that people want to understand. Please understand that you can hurt yourself, you know, with these things. There's a lot of blind laser jocks that looked at the path of a near-infrared laser because they couldn't see it. And so I have some concern about that. That's why in our light source, we use broadband filaments. We put them all in one bulb, diffuse it, and all this other stuff. There'll be some more stuff, I think, coming out of the Guy Foundation. And probably one of the best is Roger Seeholt's MedCram videos. I know they're kind of long, but this guy's got four board certifications. He doesn't just, he's like you, he doesn't just believe me. He goes out and he's pulled together some amazing papers and done some videos. They're long. They are extremely technical, but he knows his stuff. And, you know, he's the one that's, I think, really been bringing this more to the forefront than anybody else. So Roger Seeholt on MedCram. And you can see there's probably 8 or 9 videos on our stuff.
Yeah, I've seen those. Those are really good. And his stuff in general is really good.
Yeah, he brings in a lot of really good papers that I had never even seen. And also, you know, use your common sense. You don't have to go out and fry yourself under the sun. In fact, I'd say that's the worst thing you could do. You get in the shade, enjoy the beautiful day, do some of your exercise outdoors rather than always indoors, you know. And if we're trying to figure out what to do with the DOE, I mean, they're basically mandating with these rule changes, making it mathematically impossible for us to put light sources into rooms and into houses that are healthy. And like I say, when I started this, I was just trying to make a healthier light source. Now I think I'm trying to prevent damage being done by what the industry is doing right now.
So are these new rules in place now, or are they coming?
The old rules were that that you could still get significant highlight 3-to-1 near infrared to visible. They shoved it down just in the last few months, 120 lumens per watt, because they want to get rid of all the fluorescence. So rather than mandating fluorescence out, they put this lumen per watt restriction on, which basically means that the only thing I can do is about, you know, match direct sunlight with 1-to-1, and just from a math standpoint. They totally ignored the science, and this is all politics as far as I can tell.
Well, I guess what I was after was, is this like coming like next year and people can buy stuff still, or you can't sell stuff now?
No, it doesn't come into effect until 28.
Okay. No. Buy some stuff before it's gone.
Yeah. I mean, they should. And I'm sure we'll find a way to get around it, because the DOE, you know, there's always maybe some thing to get around. But it's just, to me, it's frustrating, because, you know, it's just like, how can you ignore all this information that's out there and just haphazardly throw everybody into this environment that's exactly the opposite of what occurs in nature? We never get exposed to this kind of situation in nature.
Right. So tell the audience your company and how they would find it if they wanted to buy the lights that you sell?
Yeah, I mean, it's Nira Lighting, N-I-R-A lighting.com.
Great.
We sell screw-in bulbs. I targeted basically screw-in bulbs because I believe that the poor part of the communities are the ones that are suffering the worst. So we're trying to get it into a form factor that everybody can just screw it in and use it. I don't claim for it to be perfect. I don't claim for it to do anything other than we match sunlight as close as anybody or better. That's because I'm just an optical engineer. But again, if people can just not be afraid of the sunlight, put a hat on, a straw hat. I did my grandpa's sold straw hat and measured transmission on it. And it was just amazing how perfect it was. I mean, some of the old stuff is much better than the new stuff. And so,
fantastic. All right, Scott. Well, this was really fun. Thanks very much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. All right. Have a good one.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye. Hey, thanks so much for joining my conversation with Scott Zimmerman. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And stay tuned for part two with Glenn Jeffrey.